operating in good faith, taking his duty seriously. They submit this question. Was the finding that all jurors did not reach a unanimous decision? Now the court, instead of answering that question, inquire, as the court is supposed to do under the case law, but did not answer the jury's question directly. The court inquired and said, and asked whether or not you or all of you feel there's a likelihood of progress towards unanimous verdict if I allow you to continue. I'm not interested in how you're deciding, just whether or not it is appropriate for me to have you continue to deliberate. To which the jury foreman said, at this time, no, we're at a standstill. It's at that point where the court, first, in a variation on a timepiece instruction, tells the jury, I'm going to have you go back for about another hour, and then reads an instruction that's fairly, which is equivalent to 3814, the modified hour instruction in Colorado. At the end of that instruction, the court says, I'm going to come back and check on you in a few minutes to see if you're making progress. And then discharge the jury for further deliberations around 5 till noon, something like that. I think they go off the record at noon. The court comes back a few minutes later and says, the jurors are indicating they're making progress. Just as the court had said, the court apparently had checked on the jurors and the jurors had indicated their progress. And then, by 12:30, the case was over. The jurors had returned the verdict less than 30 minutes after they heard this modified hour instruction. Why is this problematic? The biggest problem with this is that the court did not answer the jury's question. The jurors' question, again, what is the finding of all jurors not reaching unanimous decision? Clear on its face. The answer to that is clear on its face. The court can discharge the jurors without a verdict in its discretion. The jurors are left wondering what the answer to their question is. And that's compounded by the court ignoring the jury foreman's statement that further deliberations would not be appropriate. In direct answer to the court's question, the foreman said, at this time, no, we're at a standstill. It's in that context that we have to look at reading the modified hour instruction, which we all agree here, in this case, was substantially equivalent to what the pattern instruction says. It's in that context that the modified hour instruction is not sufficient to wipe away any concerns, because, again, the court is not answering the jury's question, one of the two duties I mentioned at the outset. And the court is not showing a sensitive regard to the juror's concerns here. By not answering the juror's question and by not responding to the foreman's statement that we're at a standstill, rather going with the road of instruction, with the addition of a time frame, which this court has found impermissible in the past. So what should the court have done in this situation?
The court, Mr. Hardy, let me just interject for a second. You've twice mentioned that the court said something to the effect of, I'm going to check back in with you in an hour or so. You've referenced that. And that issue's not before us. Is that a fair statement? Even though it's discussed in the briefs, that's not part of the cert question.
It's not literally in the cert question, Justice Hood. But in these cases, these modified Allen cases, this court's jurisprudence and all of the jurisdictions I'm aware of say that you need to look at them on a case-by-case basis, considering all the circumstances that occurred. And one of the circumstances in this case was the fact that the court said, I'm going to check up or I'll send you back in about an hour. And at the end of the modified hour instruction said, I'm going to check back with you in a few minutes. So I would say that falls within the rule as things that are directly related to the cert question under this court's law.
Just follow up with that a minute. So are you saying the fact that he told the jury he'd check back up on them has something to do with whether he should have told them, as the cert question is more expressly, that they would be dismissed and a mistrial would be granted? Or you're saying that's a separate problem, but we should look at that as well?
Well, I do think they're related. I think that, again, I think you have to take this all these circumstances as under the context in which they occur. And the context in which the court was saying, I'll check back with you in a few minutes here, was after the court didn't answer the question, which would have been answered by a mistrial advisement of some sort. And and the juror's question here indicates a concern with the length of deliberations compounded by the foreman saying we're at a standstill, the court not answering the jury's question and moving straight to modified Allen without addressing the standstill either, and then something suggesting to the jurors that, you know, you should be making progress in a few minutes, all of those circumstances together are the court conveying to the jurors here that not only do I want a verdict from you, but you should be able to do it in a few short minutes, or at least start making progress.
To put those two together, I mean, I assume you're agreeing, seemed like what we were trying to get away from in the old days, at least when we talk about a time fuse, that the worst thing would it not have been to say, I mean, the thing that clearly would have been improper would have been to say, you have so much time, and then I'm going to grant a mistrial if you don't come back with a verdict. You're agreeing with that. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, this court's Allen case stands for, not in a per se context, but under the circumstances of that case, stands for the proposition that if the court gives the juries a time limit and threatens a mistrial if they don't meet it, that that's a coercive situation. But I do think there's a significant difference between telling the jury that this option, you can be discharged without a verdict, exists, and telling the jury, I want you to make some progress, and you've got an hour to do it, if not, I'm going to declare a mistrial. I mean, there are circumstances where we're talking about mistrial could certainly be coercive. For instance, if the court, you know, thinks that for some reason, whatever the indication is, that the jurors aren't taking their duties seriously enough, and says, if you don't get serious, this is going to be a mistrial, it's going to have all these awful consequences. Certainly in that context, that would be a coercive situation. But on the opposite end of the spectrum, when the jurors are indicating a concern that there's no way their service can end without a unanimous verdict, at that point, as in this case, when they literally ask the question, what happens if we can't reach a verdict, at that point it becomes coercive nonsense.
Please go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to do one follow-up there. So it seems like you're saying the jury wouldn't have been able to figure that if they couldn't come to a verdict, there would be a mistrial. Something would happen, they would be released. And yet, with regard to the judge saying, I'll check back on you in a few minutes, I hear you saying they would understand from that if they didn't make progress in a few minutes, he would grant a mistrial.
No. Not exactly. What the jury is hearing in the judge's communication in this case is that there is no third option, that a unanimous verdict is all you have. I mean, we presume that the jury follows the instructions it's been given, and all the instructions the jury is given in the packet when they go back talk in terms of you shall deliver a verdict, the foreman shall sign the verdict that you reach. There's no third option to discuss. And in this case, when the jurors trigger that information, ask directly the judge for that information, it becomes clear that their concern is we don't know if there's any other end to this. And then in the context of the judge saying he's going to come back and check on them, what the judge was conveying by not answering the question and by marching through the modified Allen instruction despite the standstill was that you have to reach a decision in this case, much like United States Supreme Court in Jenkins, 1965. And then when he follows it up with, I'll come back a second in a few minutes, he's acting the role of this one area. Not only do you have to reach a verdict, but it shouldn't be hard. I want you guys to get to it.
That's a small point, but the court said about an hour, as I recall. Right?
At first, before reading the pattern instruction, the court says, I'm going to give you about an hour. And then after reading the pattern instruction, the court says, I'll come check on you in a few minutes.
You seem to be saying that by merely asking the question, what is the finding if all jurors do not reach unanimous verdict, that phrasing in and of itself conveys a clear message that we're at an impasse and we're concerned that we're going to be stuck here into eternity. And I guess I'm a little concerned from the wording of this particular question if that's necessarily an inference to be drawn. And it seems to me that where I see some common ground between you and the prosecution here is the notion that where we do have an indication that the jury is under a basic misapprehension, that they will be forced to deliberate unless until they arrive at a verdict, then yes, that might be a proper circumstance. But I'm struggling to understand why we leap to that inference from this specific question.
Well, again, taking all the circumstances in the case as all the cases direct us, we must. The fact that the jury had been out over 2 days for 4 to 5 hours in a case with evidence of only like 3 to 3.5 hours, and this is the question they come back with: what is the finding of all jurors members of unanimous decision? Coupled with the foreman statement when the court required that the jurors were at a standstill and no further deliberations would be appropriate. Those circumstances together indicate a context in which what the jurors were done. What the jurors wanted to know was the original instructions don't provide for any option besides not guilty or guilty unanimous. We are not unanimous. Why let's our service end?
Mr. Hardy, I'm sorry to take your time. Quick question. Are you just concerned that there was an abuse of discretion in this case? Are you asking us, or alternatively, are you asking us to write, given that we're doing three of these kinds of cases today, a much broader rule? And if so, what is the much broader rule?
I do believe that the trial court judge abused discretion in this situation for the reasons I mentioned at the outset. He didn't comply with the two duties of responding to the juror's question and showing sensitive concerns of avoiding coerced verdict. In terms of a broader rule, the rule I would write is just that jurors should be advised of a non-unanimous discharge option if they either ask the court about it directly, ask a question that prompts that response, or other indications that jurors are concerned that there is no other end to their service. And that advisement wouldn't have to use the term mistrial. That advisement shouldn't have any sort of punishing language such as, and you know, this case will have to be retried.
So in summary, then you're concerned that this judge abused his discretion, this trial judge did, and the Court of Appeals erred in saying that you should never do this.
Absolutely.
You're concerned on those two levels, is that right?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Brady?
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people or the respondents in this case. The people do agree that the trial court is not required to give a mistrial instruction in every case. The people also agree that there's no need for a per se ban on the mistrial instruction for the precise reason that there might be unique circumstances, although very odd, where a jury has not ever heard of a hung jury, which I think is in the vernacular, but I think it is a possibility. And I think it would be clear to the court that the jury thinks that they have to return a verdict or stay in deliberations forever. There's a back and forth going on with the court, the jury sends out questions. When deliberations take too long, the court checks on their progress. I think this is something that can certainly be figured out. So the people agree that the answer to the third question is no, and that the Court of Appeals did err by giving a rule that there should be a per se ban on mistrial instruction, and in fact that was not dicta.
What in your mind would trigger an instruction to tell the jury about a mistrial?
Basically, one of the parties should request it, and it's usually the defense, because it's the defense that complains on appeal that there was coercion.
Well, the defense did request some explanation in this case, didn't they? But what distinguishes this case, then, from the hypothetical you're talking about?
Well, they... Can I answer that with a quote?
Sure, we'll allow you to read for this point.
Okay. The trial court has a duty to employ all legal and reasonable means to secure a verdict at trial. And that's from People v. Schwartz, 678 P. 2nd, 1000, page 1011 from 1984. It also says that the law prohibits coercion by improper influence, but the trial court has broad discretion to decide what instructions and when, and there shouldn't be an absolute rule. Quite often those can lead to automatic reversal rules when they're not complying with.
Could I follow up just one more then?
Sure.
I appreciate the quote and what you said, but I'm still not quite sure then why didn't the judge abuse his discretion in this case, and when would he abuse his discretion?
In this case, the jury did not indicate that they had no idea that there are such things as a hung jury. All they did is ask a question. They said, what is the finding if we're at a standstill, basically. They were asking the judge what to do. They were not indicating that we think we have to stay in here until we return the answer.
So are you suggesting sort of a magic word approach? I need to use those words, but if the jury says, we've never watched TV in our lives before, we've never heard of a hung jury, can you help us with what's going to happen?
I think we have the back and forth going in between the trial court and the jury with jury questions. They're not going to stay in there forever. If they stay in there too long, the trial court will check on their progress. In this case where the jury did indicate, okay, we have a problem here, it was up to the trial court to answer that question at its discretion.
I'm really want you to be very specific because this is really tough for trial judges. So what exactly do you want us to tell them? That if they say what, then they're required, if jurors say what, then they're required to do what?
If the jurors say we're never going to be able to arrive at a verdict, we don't know what to do, then that's when the court gives the modified Allen instruction, and that's what that pattern instruction is for.
And so with that in mind, the jurors did convey we're at a standstill. So why does that not qualify?
It did qualify for, it certainly didn't qualify for the trial court to say at that point, oh, okay, you don't agree, well then you can just quit and go home. The trial court does have a duty to inform them of the law that's necessary to the verdict. The trial court just can't tell them what the verdict should be, and you know, it should be delivered right now.
I guess I'm just trying to tie in back with the Chief's question about when to draw the line, and how's the trial judge supposed to know where that line, when that line has been reached?
I don't exactly know where the line is. I think we just give trial courts a lot of discretion to determine that and then examine the record.
So should this case, in your opinion, should our opinion stand for nothing more than to get rid of the word never from the Court of Appeals decision?
Basically, yes.
And so your position is as long as there's not precedent out there that says never, the Attorney General is okay with that?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Well, actually, may I follow up on that too? Because I understood your brief to also say that it's incumbent upon the defendant to actually request such an instruction.
To preserve review. Otherwise, it's plain error review.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Brady, good morning. Can I follow up on that just a little bit? You've used the phrase, the jury's been out too long a couple of times. How do we incorporate that? That's really hard to decide, especially from a trial court perspective. How long is too long?
I think the way that we incorporate that is it would be the same factors that a trial court would look at when it decides when to declare a mistrial. The length of deliberations, the complexity of the case, whether either party has asked for a mistrial because the deliberations just seem to be going on too long for, you know, the short length of the case or a very simple case.
Let me follow up. Do you think that the jury should prompt, or should the court go in on their own and bring them in and say, boy, you guys have been out a long time?
I think at some point the court can check the progress, yes.
Okay, and if we were writing something to give guidance, how would you suggest we describe that?
I say that the court would use just the same, I think there's five factors that the court looks at in deciding whether to declare a mistrial. And as I, the ones that I can remember are the length of deliberations and comparing that to the complexity of the trial, and whether either party has requested that the judge check on the progress because they're concerned.
Thank you.
Let me ask one more if I can. I'm still a little uncertain. If, when the jury comes back and says we're not making progress, there's no point in us deliberating, if that brings into play then giving a modified Allen charge, what is it beyond that brings into play advising them that the court can declare a mistrial?
I think that, again, would have to be one of the parties requesting it, and then the trial judge making a decision, is it time to tell them that, should we tell them that, or should we just declare a mistrial?
And so, yeah, so it's not, the way you're posing that, it doesn't sound like it's a question of the jury wanting to know that, but rather a question of one of the parties waiving any objection to a counter inference that might be drawn from giving that kind of instruction. Is that right?
That's one way of putting it, but I think you also do have to take in consideration when the jury is asking a question or just sending out a note saying we're out of standstill.
I guess the fundamental question for me is, as you go back and look at the history of this doctrine and why we wanted to get rid of time fuse and related things, how do we know whether the jury will infer from an instruction about mistrial that therefore they don't need to deliberate anymore, and so rather than deliberate harder and come back with a not guilty, they'll just go for a mistrial, or whether on the other side they might say, oh, rather than come back with a verdict of guilty after deliberating, we'll go for a mistrial?
You're correct, we don't know. It could go either way, and that's up to the parties, usually the defense, who would have appeal for the jury and decide, is this going my way or not going my way? Do I want a mistrial declared, or do I want the jury told, you can, maybe they don't need to wear a mistrial, you can be discharged if you are unable to agree.
Okay.
Should it matter in your view if, as part of that assessment, the jury has given indication where the vote currently stands, or is that totally irrelevant to your approach?
Well, because of 606B, we have to be very careful about, you can't really hold the jury or ask the jury.
So to extend it volunteers in a note, hey, we're at 10-2 or 11-1 or something like that.
That's a very bad thing if they do that. and kind of on thin ice when that happens.
Why isn't never more in keeping with Allen and his progeny? It seems Ragland was something that was just taken from a CJD. It doesn't really seem to have any genesis in this court's jurisprudence. So why isn't never more in keeping with avoiding any potential for coercion as Allen seemed to try to achieve?
It's simply because if you tell the jury too soon that they can basically avoid making a difficult decision, then they might go with that and not return a verdict and just be discharged and leave it to another jury, which results in a lot of retries.
Maybe I'm not understanding your response correctly. What I'm saying is, why is the Court of Appeals approach in saying never give this kind of instruction appropriate? Why isn't that more in keeping with our case law, ultimately?
I think
maybe that's what Justice Coates is getting at, too. I don't mean to speak for him.
Okay, no, I think that is one way of putting it, that it would be. I just never say never. I mean, if we say never, you can never do this, then some odd circumstance comes up, and it might be needed.
And I don't mean to hog your time, but one additional question. You would agree that the, I guess it was the 3814, the modified Allen instruction here did not have to be given. Like, the trial court always retains the discretion to determine whether it should give a modified Allen instruction at all.
That's correct. All of these instructions are discretionary. No further questions?
Well, actually, before you sit down, I'm still struggling with your, I understand you're saying we should have no per se approach, correct? That it should be purely discretionary, but still, I mean, I guess you're arguing here that there was no abuse of discretion, correct?
Absolutely.
And, but why, I guess, is the, I know we've asked you that three times, but I'm just wondering, why was there no abuse of discretion in this instance? And what I hear you saying is sort of an escalation approach. The jury came out with one question, that wouldn't have been enough. Maybe had they come out a number of additional times, or, I mean, how do you quantify that part of your argument?
Well, the jury did tell the trial court it was at a standstill.
Correct. And I know Justice Marquez asked you that question. You know, why was it not an abuse at that point?
Because the trial court apparently felt that they had not deliberated long enough.
Okay. So they needed to go back at it.
And they needed to go back at it, and it was a case where the jury could, in fact, return verdicts. I mean, this trial was not necessary.
And that's, and how do we describe that?
Other than trial court discretion.
Other than simply that the trial court judge at that point thought they had to work harder.
The judge is there. The judge, just like the parties, can get a feel for the jurors. You know, the trial court is there in the presence of the jury. I've been through voir dire. Knows what's going on. The judge is in the courtroom.
I apologize, Justice Ida, if you're not finished.
Yeah, no, I'm good.
Is it even really necessary for us to get into all that here? The cert question seems to be pretty narrow on the issue of whether it was would have been appropriate for the Bradley language to be included.
Correct.
And
that's right. And that's why I said at the outset that we both agree the answer to the cert question is no, and I'm happy to stop there.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brady. Mr. Hardy? You have some 23 seconds left.
I'll just say that there are competing interests here. Of course, we want verdicts, generally speaking. But a mistrial is a legitimate end to a trial. And if the jury is giving indications that they are not aware that there's a third non-unanimous discharge option, that should be cleared away with concrete accuracy. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Martin. Thank you, Ms. Brady.